Cabot and Price were right, but to many people they seemed wrong. In 1968, the fund industry had been riding high, as 84% of stock funds beat the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Then, beginning in 1969, the go-go fund managers started to sputter. The stock market overall lost nearly half its value from its high in the 1960s to its low in 1974. And the go-go funds did even worse. Size Manhattan Fund, a top performer in 1967 with a gain of 39%, lost more than 70% of its value by September 1974. Sy and other star managers lost their luster. Business Week ran a 1972 article titled, "Sy Touch No Longer Seems So Golden." Sy and many other go-go managers left the mutual fund industry, and the go-go era ended in flames. However, the go-go funds didn't disappear. Instead, they were given a different name to distinguish them from the standard growth fund, like that introduced by T. Rowe Price. The new name was Aggressive Growth Fund. But in the early 1970s, with the stock market falling and interest rates rising, the reputations of former star managers were collapsing. Mutual fund investors withdrew more money from stock funds than they put in. Industry-wide, stock funds suffered net redemptions from 1970 until 1982. The disenchantment was reported by Business Week in July 1976.
With stocks mostly higher, the $46 billion mutual fund industry should be having a bang-up year. Instead, record numbers of investors are taking advantage of higher prices to sell off their fund shares. Investors who have stayed with mutual funds through the lean years of the early 1970s are now selling, and fund salesmen are finding relatively few customers willing to take their place. Performance problems are the main reason money is flowing out of the mutual funds. Not only are the funds straggling behind the market this year, but their long-term track record is hardly impressive. Fund managers note that their industry is also suffering now from the fact that the funds were sold for the wrong reason in the late 1960s, on the promise of spectacular short-term gains rather than for their potential long-term performance.
As investors continued a decade-long evacuation from stock mutual funds, the fund managers themselves fled the market, as Barron's chronicled in February 1977.
During October-December, while the Dow held in a 925 to 1,000 trading range, a number of fund managers decided to get out while they were still ahead. In fact, portfolio liquidation was the heaviest in years. Of the 76 investment companies surveyed by Barron's, five times as many sold common stocks as bought them. In the preceding quarter, bears outnumbered bulls, 4-1.
This report profiled the darkest time for stock mutual funds since the 1930s. But in May 1977, 3 months after Barron's Doerr report, a young unknown stock analyst was named manager of a floundering fund, the Fidelity Magellan Fund. His name was Peter Lynch, and he was to change mutual fund history. Peter Lynch's 13-year reign at Fidelity's Magellan Fund from 1977 to 1990 has become a legend of investment history. Lynch's total return to investors was 2,510% in a period when the Dow Jones average grew 451%. A $1,000 investment in Magellan on the day Lynch became its fund manager grew to $27,000 by the time he left. Lynch did not have one losing year. In only 2 years did his performance fail to beat the Standard & Poor's 500 index. But Lynch remembers the discouraging outlook when he entered the world of mutual funds.
When I hired on as an analyst at Fidelity in 1969, the market was just entering one of its doldrums. stock prices had peaked and were headed toward the 1972 to 74 collapse, the worst since the 1929 to 32 collapse that preceded the Depression. Suddenly, nobody wanted to buy mutual funds. There was no interest at all. Business was so terrible that the flotilla of salesmen was forced to disband. The salesmen returned to selling vacuum cleaners or car wax or whatever else they'd sold before the funds got hot. In 1966, Fidelity Magellan was a $20 million fund, but the steady outflow of money from the customers' redemptions reduced it to a $6 million fund by 1976.
From this low point, Lynch's spectacular investment results propelled Magellan to become the world's largest mutual fund, with $13 billion in assets when he retired in 1990. A self-proclaimed investaholic, Lynch used a bold investment approach that differed from that of most mutual fund managers in the late 1970s, when many were still shell-shocked from the bearish chaos earlier in the decade. Lynch worked hard to uncover promising individual companies. His personal image as a hard-working, thoughtful analyst was a strong contrast to the glamour of the swaggering gunslingers of the go-go era. Lynch became a role model for other mutual fund managers when a bull market atmosphere returned to Wall Street beginning in 1982. But before the 1980s bull market brought renewed interest in stock mutual funds, the mutual fund industry had creatively reshaped itself during the 1970s. Some people in the mid-1970s had begun to call the mutual fund concept extinct, and the introduction of the money market fund helped the industry survive. After being made available to investors in 1972, money market funds were broadly accepted by the general public, and this achievement is usually credited to Howard Stein, then head of the Dreyfus Corporation. Nancy McConnell, writing in Institutional Investor magazine, recaps the story of Stein's innovations.
Stein took the idea of a mutual fund that would enable small investors to earn money market rates. The cash market had until then been the sole domain of institutions and corporations, and in a move that forever changed the shape of his company as well as the mutual fund business, decided to aggressively peddle such a fund directly to the public with no sales charge. The first direct marketed, no-load money market fund, Dreyfus Liquid Assets, was born in February 1974. Within a year, Dreyfus, which had a total of $2 billion in assets under management at the end of 1973, had added a breathtaking $1 billion in new accounts. Then came the inflation years, when money market funds were giving the public 17 and 18% returns, and America's savings flooded in.
Stein also is credited with developing another mutual fund concept, now taken for granted by millions of Americans.
It was Stein who, in 1976, organized an intensive Washington lobbying effort to push a bill allowing the tax-free income from municipal bonds to flow through to mutual fund investors. The day the bill was signed, Dreyfus came out with the first tax-exempt mutual fund.
As interest rates started falling in 1982, the bull market started to roar. Investors who had been attracted to high income yields in money market funds in the late 70s now started shifting into other fund products. By 1984, the amount of money attracted to stock and bond funds nearly matched the total fund sales for all of the 1970s. But the distribution of that money also shifted. In 1970, nearly 81% of all mutual fund assets had been in stock funds. By 1990, less than 40% of fund assets were in stock funds. The remaining 60% generally remained evenly split between bond and money market funds. Another industry-changing development during the 1970s was the growing popularity of no-load funds. In 1970, no-load funds accounted for just 5% of the total number of funds. but as the 1970s bear market made selling funds less attractive, and as investors started blaming the salespeople for misleading promises of fund performance, the no-loads became more important. Mutual fund expert Sheldon Jacobs, a leading proponent of no-load funds, has traced their growth.
There was a pronounced trend to no-loads in the 70s and 80s, with more than 75 old-line load funds firing their salespeople and marketing shares directly to investors. Fund groups that were originally 100% load, but are now partially or wholly no-load, include Financial Programs, Vanguard, Dreyfus, and Fidelity. The newer money market funds are virtually 100% no-load. Early attempts to sell money funds with loads failed completely. No wonder. One dictionary definition of a load is a heavy burden or weight. No investor needs such a burden. Including money market funds, no-loads account for over half of the industry's total assets.
Jacobs argues that the sales load is burdensome because it immediately cuts into an investment.
The 8.5% load is really 9.3%. It's 8.5% of the money you pay out, but 9.3% of what you invest. If you put $10,000 into a load fund, $850 would go to the sales organization. The balance, $9,150, would actually be invested in stocks and bonds. Divide the $850 by $9,150, and you get 9.3%. It's amazing that so many investors accept this charge, an instant loss of 9.3%, with equanimity. If these same investors bought the basket of stocks comprising the Dow at 7,000 and the next morning saw it drop 650 points to 6,350, they would be beside themselves with anguish. But that's exactly the same as the loss you incur paying the 8.5% load.
Advocates of load funds continue to argue for their usefulness. Mutual fund columnist Carol Gould of the New York Times offers reasons why she believes a load fund may sometimes be the best route.
If you are willing to fully research your own fund investments, obtain prospectuses, build a portfolio of funds, and then regularly monitor your investments, paying a sales load may not make sense. There's little point in paying someone else for a service you can perform yourself. On the other hand, if you think that you receive sound advice from the financial planner or stockbroker who helps choose your investments, the load may be worth the cost. The money buys you more than the fund shares. You also buy the advice and expertise of the salesperson. In the end, you're better off with a good fund that costs more than a poorly performing fund you can buy cheaply.
The arguments for and against load funds are fodder for a perennial debate. Meanwhile, an even more controversial fee first appeared in 1980 because of the weakness among mutual funds during the 1970s. So much money was being pulled out of mutual funds and put into high-yielding bank certificates of deposit that government officials began to fear that banks and savings and loan companies might come to dominate the financial world completely. To help the weakening fund industry in its efforts to regain some of its appeal, the Securities and Exchange Commission voted to allow funds to charge shareholders a fee to help offset the costs of marketing and promotion, costs traditionally covered by the fund's management fee. This so-called 12B1 fee was originally intended to help the promotion of no-load funds. But almost immediately after coming on the scene in 1980, the fee was used in other ways, as Sheldon Jacobs explains.
Load fund groups realized they could use the 12B1 fee to compensate sales personnel and broker-dealers for their services. Collecting a 12B1 fee in lieu of a front-end load gave load funds a terrific marketing advantage. Because the 12B1 fee is paid to fund management at regular intervals out of the fund's net assets, just as the management fee is collected. Unless the prospective fund purchaser reads the prospectus carefully, the fee was, for all practical purposes, hidden. It will come as no surprise to learn that salesmen don't go out of their way to explain this fee. And until 1988, these funds were listed as no-load in the newspaper price quotations. Consequently, salesmen frequently told their clients they were buying no-loads. What they meant, of course, was that the client didn't pay an upfront sales charge. That's not the same as no-load.
Beginning in 1993, funds no longer could call themselves no-load if their 12B1 fee was greater than 0.25%. In general, however, any financial consultant, financial planner, or money manager who buys mutual funds for a client is compensated by some type of load or service charge, like the 12B1 fee, charged by the fund company and paid to the agent. An exception is when clients pay advisors directly on a fee-only basis. The government's approval in 1980 of the 12B1 fee made it easier to market mutual funds. Another government action that helped mutual funds was the creation of the Individual Retirement Account, or IRA, which for the first time in history gave the mass of Americans a tax-deferred savings vehicle for retirement. The IRA had first been allowed by law for people not covered by employers' pension plans. In 1982, the IRA was extended to all workers. That first year of universal eligibility, 1982, saw a rush of more than $28 billion into IRA contributions, much of it into mutual funds. This was the first year of the bull market of the 1980s. Financial writer Joseph Nocera describes the impact of tax-deferred IRAs on the psychology of investing.
It is right to say that because the pool of capital that made up an IRA could not be withdrawn for 20 or 30 years, many people viewed their IRAs as containing money they could experiment with. They could use an IRA to buy their first stock or their first mutual fund. IRAs gave people a way to try on the stock and bond markets for size, to see how they felt, and to become slowly comfortable with the idea of investing. The knowledge that the money couldn't easily be withdrawn acted as a psychological safety net, allowing investors to feel as though they could take a chance or two. If they made a mistake, they reasoned there was still time to recoup, several decades perhaps.
At first, all IRA contributions were fully tax-deductible and tax-deferred. But when lawmakers saw a greater-than-expected loss of tax revenue, they made most IRAs non-deductible after 1986. Despite this change, IRA contributions continued to be a significant source of new contributions to mutual funds. Typically, nearly half of the annual inflows into mutual funds occur before the tax filing deadline of April 15th. As fewer people became eligible for IRA deductions, another idea was starting to develop, the 401k retirement plan, where contributions are deducted from paychecks and earmarked primarily for mutual funds. As fewer companies continued to offer fixed benefit pension plans, a tradition of American life for more than a generation, individuals became responsible for their own financial futures. And with this, the mutual fund became a dominant financial force in nearly every segment of the U.S. investment market. As Americans embraced mutual funds and abandoned traditional savings outlets, such as insured bank deposits, the lessons regarding investment risk were not always understood, and sometimes not clearly defined by the mutual fund industry. For many Americans, the first mutual fund experience after the money market funds of the 1970s was a bond fund in the 1980s and early 90s. The number of bond funds grew from 35 in 1975 to 492 in 1985, 1,600 in 1992, and more than 2,000 by early 1994. Assets grew 15-fold between 1984 and 1994, from $54 billion to nearly $800 billion. Bond fund expert Werner Renberg explains why.
With short-term interest rates down from their double-digit levels, investors were easily persuaded to seek higher income by switching to government bond funds and government-backed mortgage securities funds, which were spreading like dandelions, promoted with tempting, if misleading, phrases such as government guarantee and safety. When government bond yields fell, the search for high income led promoters of taxable funds and their investors down the credit quality ladder, first to funds invested in corporate bonds of high and medium investment quality, and then to funds concentrated in bonds of lower quality, usually called high yield or junk bonds. With so much attention given to maximizing yields, many investors were not made adequately aware of or just remained oblivious to the one risk inherent in all marketable bonds and the funds that own them, that bond prices fall when interest rates rise.
The risk of rising interest rates meant little to bond fund investors during the 1980s and for most of the 1990s. As interest rates dropped steeply from what had been historic highs. But in 1994, interest rates climbed, and many bond fund shareholders saw the value of their shares plunge. Heavy redemptions followed, and the bond fund area stopped its incredible growth rate. Many bond fund investors failed to understand the central fact that putting money in a bond fund is not the same as buying a bond and holding it to maturity. Rather, bond fund investing is a way to put money into the bond market, with a collection of different bonds maturing at different dates. Funds that have longer average maturity dates provide typically higher yield to compensate investors for tying up their money for longer periods of time. However, longer maturity dates also have a higher risk of losses when interest rates go up, because the investor is locked into the past lower rates for a longer period of time. Many newcomers to bond funds were surprised when the value of these shares dropped during the mid-1990s. This also was a time that tested the common assumption that money market funds are completely safe. Although it received little attention at the time, several mutual fund companies bailed out their money market funds with millions of dollars to make up for investments that had failed. While no money market fund marketed to individuals was allowed to break the buck, the traditional $1 per share price, investors were warned that fund companies were not required by law to guarantee a constant valuation of $1 per share, which money market shareholders had grown accustomed to since the 1970s. As money market fund managers look for ways to increase yield, risks increase for their shareholders, and this prompted warnings to shareholders who were shopping for money market funds. Marshall Loeb, former managing editor of both Fortune and Money magazines, offers these general guidelines for selecting a money market fund.
First, know the manager or sponsor. You may already do business with a firm that sponsors a money fund, say a brokerage house, a life insurance company, or a mutual fund group. A sponsor with an established reputation for financial responsibility will not jeopardize that reputation by abandoning its customers. Strong sponsorship can give investors more peace of mind. Second, go to funds whose securities have a low average maturity. The temptation of money fund managers is to extend their maturities to lock in high returns when they think interest rates are about to fall. These days, however, a Securities and Exchange Commission rule compels most funds to stay within an upper limit of 60 days. By going longer, the funds risk having to report sharp cuts in daily dividends if they guess wrong and rates rise. You should favor a fund that doesn't stray far from the average maturity dates of the pack. When other funds are hovering around the 35-day mark, be wary of those with higher average maturities. Third, don't chase after the highest possible yields or the hottest fund of the month. Over a year's time, the difference in interest payment between one fund and another is likely to be inconsequential.
As investors learned the risks of bond fund investing and of money market funds, other mutual fund watchers questioned the very role of active money management. Some such observers completely oppose Irving Fisher's 1920s claim that professional money managers are skilled with near-infallible investment acumen. These advocates, who support the so-called efficient market theory, argue that no money manager, or at least very few money managers, can consistently beat the market averages. This negative view of professional investment management in either stock or bond markets led to the creation of stock and bond index funds in the mid-1970s. John Bogle, head of the Vanguard Group of investment companies, was a pioneer in creating index funds for the investing public, and he summarizes the characteristics of index investing.
Simply put, an index mutual fund is a fund that owns a full participation in some particular segment of the financial market. By far the most common variety of index fund, and the one with the longest history behind it, is a fund that replicates the Standard & Poor's Composite Price Index. This index is heavily weighted by the stocks with the largest capitalizations, and historically has represented about 70% of the value of all U.S. common stocks.
Bogle and other proponents of index investing point to a number of statistical studies that say index funds achieve better results than most managed funds.
One major academic study suggested that only about 2 of every 5 equity mutual funds has outperformed the market over time, and only about 1 of every 5 has done so when sales charges are taken into account.
Index investing has many detractors, and they criticize indexed investing from many different angles. One such detractor is the financial writer and investment counselor John Train, who remarks in his book entitled The Craft of Investing,
"Few investors succeed in beating the averages, but it does not necessarily follow that they should buy index funds, which have their own costs and an arbitrary makeup. There is nothing magic about the Standard & Poor's 500 average. So why try to replicate it rather than a growth average or a global average? Furthermore, as more managers buy funds indexed to a particular average, the stocks that make up that average become more expensive and thus less attractive to own than similar stocks not in the average."
Index advocate John Bogle replies,
"There are many individual managers who will outpace appropriate market indexes. It seems fair to argue that before taking costs into account, half will and half will not. But two basic questions remain. One, can these managers be identified in advance? Two, will their superiority be sufficient to overwhelm the costs of acquiring their services? The respective answers are, one, only with some combination of judgment or luck. Two, only in the minority of cases."
As the mutual fund industry has become larger and more complex, more and more investors have begun to agree with Bogle. By the mid-1990s, index fund investing was the biggest growth area in mutual funds. But it may be important to remember that this was a period of rapid escalation in stock market averages, so index investing naturally prospered. Of course, the style that prospers today may be ill-suited for tomorrow. And above all, investing is essentially a forward-looking activity. The best investors are those who can anticipate how today's conditions will create tomorrow's realities. As mutual fund options have grown so explosively, there has come to be an exciting, if not overwhelming, array of mutual fund choices. There are funds dedicated to many investment styles, to various countries or regions, even funds that spread investments among other kinds of funds in various proportions. For some, the chore of choosing a mutual fund may contradict the original mutual fund idea, which was to make investment decisions easier for the small investor. Small investors who are confused by all the options might take some small comfort in the fact that even most professionals disagree widely on the best route to take. By the mid-1990s, there were more stock mutual funds than there were stocks listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And this fact itself illustrates the overwhelming nature of fund selection. One professional observer of the mutual fund scene, who has watched their explosive growth firsthand, is Bill Griffith, longtime anchorman on financial television network CNBC. After interviewing hundreds of mutual fund managers and industry experts, Griffith reached this conclusion.
If there is a simple truth to be taken from my experience, it is that there is no single correct answer when it comes to investing. Success and failure are relative. Don't try to find the most successful mutual fund that was ever created. It doesn't exist. Some funds may run longer hot streaks than others, but all funds have their periodic dry spells. That is simply a fact of life in the investment world. The key to successfully investing in mutual funds is first deciding which part of the investment world you're comfortable with, and then finding a fund manager who agrees with you.
It's not always easy to maintain such a view. Mutual fund companies working in a highly competitive environment continually advertise their funds as the best choices, with unique features. Various services continually devise mathematical formulas to rate funds. Advisors, professors, and financial writers all compete to devise a model portfolio of funds designed to maximize return based on asset allocation. But some professional advisors depart from this practice by suggesting that successful mutual fund investing is more a matter of avoiding the pitfalls than finding the perfect fund. One key ingredient is to realistically understand your own tolerance of risk. Peter Lynch offers this advice.
Warren Buffett's admonition that people who can't tolerate seeing their stocks lose 50% of their value shouldn't own stocks also applies to stock funds. People who can't tolerate seeing their mutual funds lose 20 to 30% of their value in short order certainly shouldn't be invested in growth funds or general equity funds. Perhaps they should choose a balanced fund that contains both stock and bonds, or an asset allocation fund, either of which offers a smoother ride than the ride they'd get on a pure growth stock fund.
As Wall Street veteran John Train observes, understanding your risk tolerance and understanding the way various investment options can expose you to risk are keys to avoiding the common pitfall of chasing after short-term performance. According to Train,
few funds beat the averages, and most fund investors do worse than the funds by switching into exciting ideas nearer the end of a run than the beginning. Therefore, a key rule is don't go head over heels into funds that have been hot recently because their area of concentration has boomed. This tactic performs significantly worse than the market.
With so many funds to choose from, and so many promising approaches to try, there are many temptations to constantly change your investment strategy, and this can be counterproductive. Fund counselor Gerald Perrett recommends a temperate approach.
Avoid becoming a mutual fund junkie. Establish a concrete investment objective and invest in only those funds that make a meaningful contribution to your long-range plan. Eliminate redundancy and increase your return potential by investing in an appropriate number of mutual funds. Periodically audit your mutual fund portfolio. Classify each fund by investment objective and management style. Eliminate those whose objectives and styles overlap.
Part of the challenge is to define your strategy for a portfolio of different types of funds, and then to select specific funds within the categories you choose. Another challenge is to monitor and evaluate the performance of your funds, and perhaps to sell them when your objectives change. Another quite obvious reason for making a change would be if performance lags your expectations. But the analysts Albert Fredman and Russ Wiles offer this caution.
Poor performance is the number one reason people become dissatisfied with an investment. But you don't want to dump a good fund just because it had a bad quarter or two. Moving frequently among funds on the basis of quarterly results gets expensive and normally doesn't make sense. However, if a mainstream stock portfolio has significantly lagged behind its peers for perhaps 18 months, it's probably time to move on. You should give a faltering aggressive growth fund even less time to prove itself. A volatile laggard can do some really bad damage.
While Fredman and Wiles recommend selling when a fund's performance lags its peer group, they also plead for patience with funds that stick to an investment style even when it is out of fashion.
Even if the investment style or approach pursued by your fund is out of favor, that's not necessarily a good reason to dump it. It's wise to remain diversified across different styles, because you can't predict when a particular approach will come back into the limelight. Don't think so badly of your large stock growth fund if similar types of portfolios also have been in the doghouse.
Such advisors also find other reasons for choosing to sell.
A change in management also might justify selling your fund. The change could raise a big red flag if the portfolio is a solo fund or part of a small group, because it may not be feasible to replace the talented individual. A change might be inconsequential if a committee runs the fund. Rising expenses represents another possible reason to sell, so it's wise to keep tabs on your fund's expense ratio. Costs are especially important with bond funds.
Personal decisions about risk, selection, reassessment, and adjustment are being played out on a scale unprecedented in world history. Until the second half of the 20th century, investing was the province of a relatively few people. Now, more people than ever are active investors, and this is a profound social phenomenon. The Harvard Business Review was prophetic in 1925 when it described how mutual funds can improve lives.
The small investor who has a safe outlet for his capital in the form of fund shares is therefore encouraged to save. It makes for thrift and capital accumulation among members of the community, who in turn become more interested in questions of taxation and the like. A large class of people of this sort is an asset to any country, because the magic of private property not only turns grains of sand into gold, but also alters one's outlook upon